You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
I'm thrilled to get to introduce our next keynote speaker, Dr. Chandran Kukuthas. Chandran Kukuthas is the Dean and Lee Kong Chian Chair Professor of Political Science at the School of Social Sciences at the Singapore Management University. Previously, he has taught at the London School of Economics and Political Science, where he served as the head of the Department of Government, the Royal Military College in Canberra, Oxford, and the Australian National University, the University of New South Wales at the Australian Defence Force Academy, and the University of Utah, where he held the Neil Maxwell Chair in Political Theory in the Department of Political Science. He is also, to our great delight, a distinguished affiliated fellow with the Hayek Program. He's a prolific scholar, having authored and co-authored a plethora of research, including his most recent book, Immigration and Freedom, published by Princeton University Press in 2021. He is a highly regarded political theorist who explores the ideas of liberalism and multiculturalism through a variety of lenses and issues, such as immigration, and by assessing Hayek's political philosophy. His work is crucial for all those interested in, concerned with, and seeking to advance liberalism in the modern world. His talk today will be on the very idea of an open society. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Chandran Kukuthas.
Well, thank you, Stephanie, for that kind welcome, and thank you to all my friends at Mercatus for organizing this and for inviting me and for putting me on a couple of surprise panels, which have served to warm me up for this occasion. I've just come from a panel, so I think my mind is ready to roll. I'm going to talk about the idea of an open society. I'm sure it's an idea that most, if not all of you in the room have come across. It's an idea that I also want to defend. I will tell you what I mean by an open society by the end of the lecture, but as an academic and as a philosopher, you know, any presentation has to be a kind of slow striptease, so you don't really get to see everything till right at the end. So, you know, be patient and all will be revealed. Okay? So, what is an open society? So there are several options, I think, for thinking about an open society. We could think of it as a kind of regime. We could think of it as an order of regimes. And we can also ask the question, must all regimes in an open society be open? That is to say, is an open society made up of societies that are themselves open societies? And I'm going to end up saying that's not the case, but we shall see. I think we can say at least at the start that if we ask the question, is an open society itself a kind of regime, that the answer is yes. Is it a regime of regimes? Yes. And we can ask, is it an order of open regimes? Then the answer is no. Now, how am I going to defend this particular conclusion? I'm going to start by suggesting that an open regime is governed by norms of toleration. So this is the key underlying conceptualization that I want to defend in thinking about an open society. So the question then becomes, what is toleration? So I'm going to give you a definition which is not particularly controversial. To tolerate is to forbear or refrain from exercising power to compel others to act or not act in ways that do or do not meet with our approval. Now, the critical thing here about toleration is that you only tolerate that which you do not approve of. There's no point in saying you're tolerating something that you like, because that's, you know. And you also only tolerate that which you have the power to suppress. Jamaica does not tolerate the United States and its presence in the region. That would be absurd, okay? But the United States might tolerate Jamaica if it had a reason to have some problem with Jamaica, but decides against acting against it. So to tolerate means to essentially to forbear from exercising power over something or someone that you disapprove of. Now, my thinking about toleration has been greatly shaped and influenced by the thinking of a 17th century French philosopher, Pierre Bayle. Much of what I'm saying here draws on his conceptualization of the question, and I'm going to give you a couple of elements of Bayle's view to really sharpen up this particular understanding that I want to defend, because it's going to be crucial to the position that I'm going to advance. So Bayle says that advocates of compulsion, that is to say non-toleration, are wrong to assert that they are justified in enforcing conformity on the grounds that they are in possession of the truth about what to think and how to behave. Crucial for Bayle is that those who think it's okay to compel others because they have the truth of the matter are wrong to think this. Okay? He wants to say that no claim to possess the truth could justify anything. Being right, or at least thinking you're in the right, doesn't give you a warrant for anything. Okay? No claim to possess the truth could justify anything, for those who are to be compelled could also assert that they possess the truth and might well further assert that they would themselves be justified in enforcing conformity to their own understanding of right thinking and right conduct. So if you think you justify it in compelling me to do something because your view is right, I might have just as much warrant, justification for doing the same to you from my perspective because I think I'm right. So for either party to insist that its own claim is the only defensible one because it is actually the truth would be for that party to beg the question, in Bayle's terms. The term begging the question here is very important because it's a term that's generally misused today. People use the term beg the question to say, this raises the question. I turned up in Washington and it turned out to be raining. It begged the question as to whether I should buy an umbrella. No, that's not what beg the question means. It raises that question, but it doesn't beg any questions, okay? Bayle is using the term beg the question in its correct formulation. To beg the question is to make an argument that presupposes a conclusion on the subject that's in fact at issue. So for either party to insist that its own claim is the only defensible one because it actually has the truth would be for that party to beg the question, since it would mean trying to settle the matter in dispute by invoking the truth of the claim, which is itself disputed. So Bayle wants to say that in religion, compulsion is never justified, for the claims of the heretic are on a par with the claims of the orthodox. So you're never justified in limiting toleration, in not tolerating. Now, this raises, and I'm using the term correctly here now, this raises the question, doesn't beg the question, it raises the question of what are the limits of toleration? So my answer to this question is that there are none. There are no limits to toleration. In fact, there can't be any limits to toleration. Let me try to explain why. Now, Pierre Bayle asserts that when we disagree about matters of doctrine, we cannot resolve conflicts or disputes that arise by appeal to the truth of our own convictions, since by hypothesis, these convictions are themselves in contention. So this implies, at least so I assert, that three alternatives present themselves. The first alternative is to exercise power to compel the weaker party to conform to our view or to submit to the more powerful party if we are weaker. That's one option. A second option is to dissociate from one another, either by leaving or compelling the other party to leave. That's the second option. The third option is to tolerate the other party. That's the option available to both parties. But now, if we reject the first two alternatives, to use force to compel conformity or to separate and go down the path of toleration, then I submit toleration cannot be limited. And this is because, having rejected the idea of using force to compel conformity, we are no longer able to say that if any form or standard is breached, conformity will be enforced. Having granted toleration, we can't now take toleration away because we've got no warrant for taking toleration away. We can't say, well, I'm not going to tolerate things that are beyond the limits, because what's at issue is usually what is the limit, meaning what is the correct view. So there is, of course, a view that says what we have to do then is we've got to appeal to justice. Justice is going to help us set the limits of toleration. This means, of course, that we need to figure out, since there are many conceptions of justice out there, and people are inventing them even as I speak, whose justice are we going to invoke, which conception of justice? And of course, the answer is easy. We invoke the right question of justice, the right theory of justice. But what is wrong with this move? It is begging the question, okay? We can't turn around and appeal to justice because that doesn't actually solve the problem. In fact, it begs the question. To resort to justice is not to draw limits to toleration, I submit. It is, in fact, to abandon toleration altogether. But now here we reach an interesting point, because the question then becomes, can we have a regime without justice? And I want to say, no, we can't. We can't have a regime without justice, even though there can be more or less unjust regimes. So how are we going to address this particular challenge? Well, here's one kind of theory that's been offered by a friend and colleague, a guy called Rainer Faust, who's at the University of Goethe University in Frankfurt. He wants to suggest that there is a way out of this particular dilemma. I want to suggest, contrary to him, that actually norms of justice are in fact decided not by morality, but by power. And in fact, the limits of toleration can't be set by morality. They can only be set by power. Now, the significance of this, I hope, will become clear shortly. But let's take a look at this particular attempt to find a moral justification for toleration and limiting toleration. So Rainer Faust wants to say that toleration is a political virtue grounded in the right of the public to a justification for any exercise of power or authority over them. Any rule which affects you has to be justified to you. You've got to be given reasons, especially if you're a dissenter. In fact, you've got to be given not just any old reason. You've got to be given reasons that you could not reasonably reject. You've got to be given a justification that is so compelling that you cannot but accept it. In fact, it's got to be the case that even to reject such reasons would be in itself unreasonable. And if you can offer someone those sorts of reasons, then you've got the kind of justification that warrants your limiting the extent of your toleration of their views or their actions. You are justified in requiring them to conform to the rules or the norms of the idea of justice that you've set before them. What I want to say is that this is simply begging the question, because in offering such reasons to people, if they do in fact reject these reasons, it is not going to be sufficient for you to say that these reasons are reasons that cannot be reasonably rejected, because what will in fact be at issue is the validity of those reasons, whether they do supply that warrant. So you can't say, well, the reason that you need to accept these reasons is that these reasons are the right reasons. And if they say, I don't accept that these are the right reasons, if you simply say that they're wrong, and they say, well, thank you very much, but I disagree, you have no warrant for enforcing anything. Though, of course, you could if you had the power. But until then, you are, I think, begging the question. It calls to mind the case of the Spanish conquest of the Americas, going back to Cortes, when the conquistadors were instructed by Ferdinand and Isabel, or Isabella, to go to the New World, meet with the natives, and offer them reasons or a justification for the landings and ultimately the takings that were to take place. They were to be preached to, explained the Gospels, taught things based on the principles of natural law. And so then they would be given a justification for what was to come. Now, after a while, the conquistadors realized, it didn't take them that long, really, that turning up on the doorstep of the natives with the scroll reading out in Latin or Spanish the teachings of the Spanish and of the church made no sense whatsoever to these people who did not speak any European language. And even if they had, they were probably unlikely to understand any of it anyway, given that it's very unlikely that illiterate peasants in different parts of Spain or Europe were also unlikely to understand anything read out to them in this way, especially if they were grounded in the principles of natural law. So the Spanish conquistadors ended up deciding it was going to save a lot of time if they just read out these requirements to trees, to stones, to the ocean, to each other. It didn't really matter, because after all, what was the point of going out in search of natives when it made no difference, right? So to my mind, this is exactly what is going on when philosophers say, we can justify toleration if we've given reasons that people cannot reasonably reject. Because if they do reject them, whether because they disagree with them or because they just don't understand them, then we're back at where we started. We're at an impasse, and all we can do is either forbear, that is to say, tolerate, or we can exercise power over them. One alternative is that we might instead say, well, there is a justification, in fact, for exercising power, for not tolerating, and this is that it's a matter of necessity. Okay, we have to do it because, you know, we have to have a regime. It's necessary for the survival of the regime. But here, I think we can still ask, well, you know, necessary for whom? Because the persons being subject to the loss of toleration may not see it that way. But no, you might say, that's too bad, but we need to do this because the regime needs to survive. We're going to offer, in a sense, these prudential reasons. If that's what we're doing, I want to suggest that actually what we're doing is admitting that what we're engaged in is not toleration. What we're admitting to is the exercise of power, which brings me to that thesis that toleration cannot be limited by morality. We cannot give moral reasons for limiting toleration. Ultimately, when we cease to tolerate, it's because we've chosen to exercise power. We could, of course, give reasons for doing that. We can always give reasons. And as Benjamin Franklin once remarked, it's great to be a reasonable person because you can always find a reason for anything you choose to do. So this is what's going to happen. But I don't think it's a great justification. It's not an unusual one. It may be an unavoidable one, but it's unavoidable because it may be the case, sadly, that the exercise of power over others is simply something unavoidable in human society, in human life. So this brings me to my conceptualization of the open society. I want to suggest that an open society is a regime of toleration. But now the question is, how can it be a regime of toleration given all that I've told you about toleration? Well, it's a regime of toleration that must depart from toleration. What is it going to justify departing from toleration? For what reason will it depart from toleration? What's it going to invoke for departing from toleration? Well, it's going to do it in the name of justice. We will depart from toleration in the name of justice, and we will do this by exercising power. And what that means is that ultimately, all regimes are in fact grounded in power. There is no escaping this. So the open society is itself still a regime of regimes that is built on power, both internally within a regime and externally across regimes. It's not a very comforting story, but nonetheless, I want to now go on a little bit further to say something more about the extent to which this is characteristic of an open society, and the extent to which a society is or is not open. And here is my conceptualization of this. It's a graph or a schematic for giving us an understanding of the nature of the open society. So as you'll see, there are two axes, and I'm going to run through this and then present you with an elaboration or theory that underpins this. Along the horizontal axis, we see a range of positions with respect to immigration. Immigration in any society or society of societies could be prohibited, or it could be deterred, or it could simply be freed to the extent that it's just tolerated. If you want to move, you can. If you don't want to, nobody cares. Or it could be promoted, or it could be required. You might think of slaves who have been transported as having been forced to move or required to move. They have emigrated, but not of their own free will. On the other hand, there are those who have been prohibited from moving from one country to the next, or maybe even within their own societies, perhaps by regimes that are isolationists in some way. I think there are very few such places, but somewhere like North Korea comes to mind at the very extreme. In most countries, what we see is that immigration is deterred. Now, on the other axis, on the vertical axis, we have the question of integration. And the question here is, how are the people within a regime, in the broader sense of regime, treated when it comes to the question of the extent to which they should conform to the norms of the society? Now, they could be prohibited from mixing or integrating with one another to the extent that some or many peoples are required to isolate, to stay where they are in their own communities, to not be a part of the larger society. At the other extreme, they could be required to integrate so that their own particular ways of life or traditions or groups are not allowed to exist independently. Everybody's got to conform, at least to some degree, maybe to a very high degree. In the middle, you might have a society in which conformity or integration is tolerated to the extent that people are simply free to go whichever way they want. They can integrate if they wish, or they cannot. Most societies are inclined, I think, either to promote integration or, in some cases, to deter it. But many societies, I think, are indifferent to varying degrees as to whether or not people really integrate. Even when they're quite keen on social unity, perhaps prepared to allow quite a considerable degree of disunity to the extent that people can go their own way with respect to the question of how they wish to live. So a society on this chart that requires immigration and requires integration might be certain kinds of empires which require everyone to conform and move them wherever they wish to move people to in the service of that empire. At the other extreme, you could find societies that are isolationist in the way that, say, South Korea is. They prohibit certain kinds of integration. Everybody's got to keep to their own station, and entry and exit is not permitted. But there are societies in different parts of this particular schematic. So I've labeled one part of this powerlism, which we'll see halfway up the integration axis. This is after the famous British politician Enoch Powell, who was against the movement of immigrants from other parts of the world into Britain in order to preserve a certain sort of conformity and national identity in Britain. He was not in favor of immigration. He wanted it prohibited to a greater degree. But he also took the view that within that society, anyone who would move there would have the same British rights as everybody else, and so would be free to live according to their own lights. In my judgment, actually, most countries in the liberal democratic West have a kind of preference for an immigration policy that is very much like Powell's. They don't want to create, for example, something like apartheid, but they want to restrict immigration, perhaps not to the extent that Powell did. But at the same time, they don't want to have second-class citizens. They don't want to have enclaves. They don't want to have ghettos and so on. There are other societies, such as that of the ancient Greeks. I've called this meticism because they're keen to accept workers coming in, but they don't want them to integrate. The metics of ancient Greece had the rights to exist, maybe work in Athens and other parts of Greece, but they did not have the right to own property. They did not have the right to integrate. On the other hand, there are societies like the Ottoman Empire, whose millet system allowed an enormous amount of freedom to the communities that existed within the empire. But nonetheless, it was an empire. Those people were conquered. They were incorporated in those lands, but they allowed those people quite a good degree of freedom. So, the open society. What I want to suggest is that an open society is what exists at the intersection between two lines. The vertical line that you draw from the middle, where immigration is free, right up to the top, and the vertical line that you would draw from the middle of the vertical axis, so the horizontal line that you would draw from the middle of the vertical axis, free, where Powellism is noted, and the intersection of those two lines gives you the heart of the open society. That's the thesis. And the further away you go from that core, the further away you get from the open society, as I've conceptualized it here. Now, there's a problem. At that very core, there is absolute toleration because nothing is prohibited. Okay? Nothing is not subject to toleration. You cannot prohibit anybody from doing anything. There is no exercise of power. But as I said before, I think any regime is ultimately going to be a regime of power. So that very center is empty. There's nothing there. To have a society, to have a regime, you have to have rules, you have to have norms, you have to have restrictions or limitations upon people. But you can't do that, I submit, without moving away from that center. And what happens to move you away from that center, given that, by hypothesis, people don't all agree? Well, someone will have to exercise power, force, to move us in one direction or another. I think this is something that is simply unavoidable, that's inescapable. We cannot have a regime that is not shaped by power. So the only question is, how far do you go away from that center? How much do you have by way of rules, norms, restrictions, limitations, punishments that force people out away from that center towards the extremities? And I want to suggest to you that the further away you go from that center, the further away you move from the ideal of an open society, because an open society is ultimately a maximally tolerant one. But the further away you move from that center, the further away you have to move from toleration, because there will be more and more things that you refuse or decline to tolerate. But as I said, you cannot avoid doing this. So to have an open society, you're still going to have to be, to some extent, someone who's willing to deter some forms of behavior or to promote some sorts of behavior. You're going to be inclined to require people to do certain things, whether it's to assimilate to a greater degree, or you're going to exclude people to some degree. You're going to exercise force, or you're going to exercise power. You may be ultimately going to exercise violence to the extent that if anybody disagrees still, dissents, refuses to comply, you're going to have to exercise force and violence in order to require their conformity. The cost of not doing this is simply not having any kind of regime at all. Now, you might say, well, maybe that's actually possible because this is a description of anarchism. What you've got is an anarchical society. Well, I think it's not going to happen to that extent. If anarchy means having absolutely no rules, if it means absolutely no kind of requirements that anybody has to follow, whether it's the respect for example, the rights of other people's property or the rights of other people to bodily integrity, well, what you won't have is anarchy in the sense that anarchists would like to see it. What you'll simply have is a complete absence of order. And even those who are anarchists don't promise that. What they promise is a regime in which the exercise of power is much, much less prevalent. But I think even they will have to concede that there has to be some kind of enforcement of norms. Otherwise, no kind of social life is possible. If someone declines to respect property rights that others accept, I don't think that even the staunchest anarchist is going to say, well, hey, look, you know, we're all anarchists here, so you do what you like. That's simply not the way things are going to work. So what I'm imagining is at the core, not the society that anarchists imagine, but a society that simply has no society in any meaningful sense. So it's actually impossible. But for it to be possible, there will have to be an exercise of power. Now, if that's the case, as I said, the question is, how far away from the center is it justifiable to move. And this is how political philosophy was invented, because this is what we've been, in a sense, arguing about for as long as people have been arguing about what is the best regime. The best regime is one, according to some theories, which embraces values of the following sort. And another theory says that the best regime is one that embraces a value of a quite different sort. And there are as many accounts of the best regimes as there are people who are interested in these questions, whether we're talking about scholars or we're talking about rulers. So where do we go from here? Well, the liberal attempt to resolve this question is essentially one that says, well, maybe what we have in a good society is a regime of regimes. We have a society in which there are different sorts of answers to this question, and we look for a way of accommodating different attitudes, outlooks, preferences, versions of the good, understandings of political order. What we have is a regime of different regimes. The further out you go from that center, however, the more tightly you will cleave to a more determinate understanding of the kinds of restrictions you want to place on people with respect to some understanding of what is good for them, or what is good for you, perhaps, or what is good for some other abstraction, like, for example, the state or the people or some other entity. The further you go towards the center, I want to suggest, means recognizing that you want to minimize the exercise of power to reach a determinate understanding of what the best regime is, recognizing that there are many ways of living, not only in terms of one's personal ends, but also in terms of how one associates with and relates to others socially, morally, legally, and politically. So the open society is a kind of regime of regimes. Now, this means we can raise a few other questions. Must an open society be made up of open societies itself to be one? I've tried to argue in a book called The Liberal Archipelago that the answer is no. A liberal society is an open society. An open society is one that is tolerant enough that it will accept within its midst other kinds of societies. Another question we might ask is, can it be closed to immigration and still remain an open society? Or to put it differently, how open to immigration must a society be to remain an open society? In a way, this is a kind of boundary drawing question, and I think this can't be answered in a straightforward way, except that I would want to say that the more open a society is to immigration, the more open it is as a society. But there are other questions to be considered here as well, given that immigration itself has many meanings and aspects to it. Do we mean by immigration simply crossing a border or a boundary, or do we mean by immigration to cross and enjoy certain rights, such as the right to work? Or does it mean having even more rights when you cross a border? Does it mean being entitled to claims of citizenship, political rights as well? Okay, depending on what you mean by immigration, you'll have different answers to this question of whether a society can be closed to immigration and remain an open society. For my money, you can be somewhat closed to the extent that, let's say, you don't allow people who enter the country automatically be eligible to stand for public office or to vote, but you allow them to work. Well, you're restricting immigration to some extent. You're restricting membership, but you're not restricting participation in society. If all you do is you allow people to come in as tourists, but they can't do anything more, well, then you're even less open to immigration, and you're even less open as a society, I would say. And finally, there's a question about what is the relationship between internal openness and external openness. given that a society might be open internally to the extent that it's extremely tolerant of different ways, it allows subgroups and subcommunities, maybe ones with radically different norms, to coexist. But at the same time, it is not open to outsiders joining them. Can it remain an open society if it's closed at a certain point, if it's closed at a certain distance or at a further distance? How open does it have to be to the outside world to remain an open society within? And my intuition, but I don't have a substantial argument for this, is that it can, but it will be on more shaky ground to the extent that it closes itself off to a greater degree. The more you open up externally, the better your chances of staying open internally. Even though I can also imagine a society being internally quite closed, but quite open externally in certain respects. Think about, for example, Saudi Arabia, quite closed internally, but on the other hand, every Muslim has the right to go to Saudi Arabia to complete the obligations that they have as Muslims, to try at least to go once on the Hajj. That makes it quite open in some ways, but very closed in another. And you can imagine other countries, you know, that have, say, something like a right of return, but internally might be quite closed. So I think a great range of possibilities are out there. And we can't necessarily say straightforwardly that openness in one respect will always mean openness in another. The good thing about this is that there's plenty of room for research. There's plenty of employment for philosophers like me. And there's plenty of opportunity for the audience to ask questions and for me to evade them. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.